Environmental groups have tried to enter the area in order to run their own tests on the soil and water, but have been forced back by policy officers working on a private contract for BP.
Today, the Northwest Realty Auction Company closed its sealed bid auction for almost 3,000 acres of the Elliott State Forest. This auction will permanently transfer parts of the forest from the Oregon Department of Forestry to the private timber company that bids the highest. Many people and groups have voiced strong protests to this land sale. KBOO's Ryan Katz has more.
Today, March 28th, is the final day in the bidding process to buy a 3,000-acre parcel of land in the Elliott State Forest. The state of Oregon is selling this land to any entity that is interested, including timber corporations, along with nonprofit companies and conservationist groups. I spoke with Julie Curtis from the Department of State Lands, and she told me a little bit about what the Elliott State Forest looks like.
The Elliott State Forest was a forest that was consolidated in the 1930s to create contiguous forest from which to derive revenue for the Common School Fund.
Now, in case that was a little bit difficult to understand through the bureaucratic lingo, basically the Common Schools Fund is a fund that was set up by the government when the state of Oregon joined the Union to harvest the state's natural resources and direct them towards schools. Julie Curtis from the Department of State Lands says that this has been going fairly well.
And over the years, it's generated quite a bit of money for Oregon schools. And over the past, several years, it's been managed to a relatively high conservation standard, but still was generating money for schools. And as a result of some litigation that just was resolved recently.
Let me stop the tape right there, because this really gets to the crux of the issue. Julie Curtis says that due to this lawsuit, the government had to scale back the amount of forestry going on in this region. This led to a lack of revenue, meant that the cost of maintaining this parcel of land was higher than the revenue coming in. Thus, it was sustainable and they needed to sell it. However, I also sat down with Erin Grady from the Cascadia Forest Defenders. She had a slightly different take.
In 2011, Cascadia Wildlands and Portland Audubon Society and Oregon Wild filed a lawsuit against the State Land Board and Oregon Department of Forestry over the mismanagement of the Elliott, which caused no cutting to happen for about a year and a half. That upset people, namely ODF and the State Land Board and Big Timber. So they came up with this plan to go over the heads of the law and the environmentalists and what we consider to be a large faction of public opinion and sell 3,000 acres.
The argument here is mainly over the funding mechanisms for the Common School Fund. Julie Curtis says that the Common Schools Fund represents a lot of money for public schools.
Well, the value as of June of last year was $1.2 billion. I think it's up to about $1.3 billion now.
However, Erin Grady says that it's just not worth it.
We're not really gaining very much funding for schools. The Common School Fund is a drop in the bucket of the school budget each year, and the Elliott State Forest is a drop in the bucket of the Common School Fund, so it's not worth it. And that's what we tried to show in economic terms. It's debatable about whether these land sales will actually maximize revenue for the Common School Fund, because if they get sold, then it's just a one-time money maker, as opposed to if they did not sell and they became timber sales, they could be used many times over.
Grady suggests just separating the funding of our schools from the mining of our natural resources. When I proposed this idea to Julie Curtis, she had this to say.
We really can't continue with a situation where a land asset that's supposed to be generating money is actually taking money from the fund. The board and our staff are very concerned about that, and what does that mean over the long term?
Grady says that this trend of privatization has several downsides.
Once it becomes private, there's lots of things that happen. Number one, they put a gate around it, and you can't go to it anymore. So places where people might have been able to enjoy recreation, old growth forest, these tracks are really beautiful. They're on the western edge of the Elliott, and we've visited them, and they're lovely places for recreation and hiking. Number two, on public lands, there is a public process for how companies have to go about logging, which means they have to buy a timber sale, and then the public has the chance to be able to comment on it. People can survey for endangered species if they want, volunteer in terms of volunteer surveys. There's a management organization that has to do surveys for endangered species, and there's a lot of checks and balances to make sure that they do that. And there's basically a chance for the public to have a voice on what's happening on their public land. And the final terrible thing that will happen to it is that private land owners clear cut, and that's what they do.
As we said, today is the last day of the bidding auction, and on Monday we will know who owns that 3,000 acres of the Elliott State Forest. For KBOO News, this is Ryan Katz.
One of the major funders of a campaign to create a public water district in Portland is the Siltronic Corporation, which is a significant water user in the city. The correlation between water and sewer usage by the Siltronic Corporation suggests the opposite of how it works for most other users of water and sewer services in Portland. Whereas most households pay from month to month more for sewer than for water, Siltronic's sewer bill on the past year was $600,000 less than its $2 million water bill. The other two businesses rounding out the top three water users are the Port of Portland, whose sewer bill for the same period was more than twice the water bill for 122 properties in the city. Dairy Gold Incorporated paid more than four times for sewer services than it did for water at six locations in Portland.
Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter will be in Portland this Sunday at Powell's Books, signing copies of his new book, A Call to Action: Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. The book details what the 89-year-old former president calls the world's most pressing human rights issue, the treatment of women around the globe. The book draws on Carter's extensive trips abroad to more than 145 countries since leaving the White House and details the abuses women face worldwide. These include the fact that one-third of all women worldwide will face sexual violence at least once in their life, and upwards of 125 million women have undergone female genital mutilation. Carter also states that each year, 14 million girls are given away as child brides and 4 million women are sold into slavery. President Carter claims that false religious interpretations have led to the majority of abuses women face. In 2009, Jimmy Carter and his wife Rosalynn left their church of 60 years, the Southern Baptist Convention, because of what Carter said was the pastor's overt use of Bible quotes claiming women are subservient to men. Carter has also called on the Pope to join him in his campaign for increased women's rights worldwide.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. In tomorrow's weather, the monsoon continues. It's rainy in the Portland area with a high of 55, 90% chance of rain. And Sunday, only a 60% chance of rain with a high of 54.
The current time is 5:14, and now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Not too many years ago, any news story about bonus money would have been about some 20-year-old baseball player, an up-and-coming superstar getting $100,000 or so on top of his salary as an extra incentive to join one team or another. Sports writers dubbed them bonus babies. How quaint. These days, stories about bonus money don't elicit cheers, for they feature some of society's least admirable people, Wall Street bankers. Far from superstars, they can be subpar performers or even what amounts to syndicate bosses overseeing everything from fraud to money laundering. Yet, in the first part of each year, we witness this cluster of greedmeisters quaffing champagne, laughing uproariously and shouting, "It's bonus time, baby!" This year, even though the Wall Street bosses have presided over a 30% drop in their bank's profits, they've extracted a 15% raise in overall bonus money, totaling a ridiculous $27 billion. That averages out to $165,000 in extra pay to each Wall Street banker. But averages deceive, for thousands of lower-level bankers are given a dab, while those up in the executive suites make off with the bulk of the heist. Michael Corbett, CEO of Citigroup, for example, didn't just grab a 15% increase in bonus pay, but nearly three times that. His total haul was $16 million. Then there's Jamie Dimon, boss of J.P. Morgan Chase. He had a really terrible year in 2013, forcing his shareholders to shell out some $22 billion in penalties for a long rap sheet of illegalities. Still, Jamie took a 74% hike in bonus money this year, a cool $18.5 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, in a time when the 90% majority of Americans see their income falling, you'd think Wall Street might show a bit of modesty.
And now the latest in worker-related news from LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Chicago's Northwestern University will appeal the National Labor Relations Board decision allowing college athletes to unionize. Football players at Northwestern petitioned to be allowed to organize a union. The AFL-CIO says the NLRB decision is great news and affirms the basic principle that people who work hard deserve fair treatment. The College Athletes Association, supported by the United Steelworkers, helped the Northwestern college athletes to win the right to organize. Schools reap millions of dollars in revenue from the work that college athletes do. Whether it's at fast food restaurants, big box retailers like Walmart or Target, or our nation's airports, workers nationwide are demanding fair pay for a fair day's work. The right to form unions without employer intimidation is also at the heart of this movement for living wages. As the Give America a Raise bus tour continues to roll through 18 cities and 11 states, baggage handler Nate Smith is standing up for higher wages and a voice on the job at Philadelphia's airport. He's tired of being exploited for $7.25 an hour, handling up to 2,000 bags a day, and he wants a union.
I believe making $7.25 is not the right way, and I believe we should have benefits, medical, and the union. I'm not afraid, and I'm going to keep fighting no matter what, because I believe we should have, like I said, a union, medical benefits, sick days. While I'm working that, I don't feel comfortable at my job, because I feel like I can get fired for any time, and that's why I believe we should just have a union.
NAFTA at 20, a new report from the AFL-CIO, sums up the impact of NAFTA. The report says, on the whole, NAFTA-style agreements, quote, have proved to be primarily a vehicle to increase corporate profits at the expense of workers, consumers, farmers, communities, the environment, and even democracy itself, end quote. The report also says the TPP and other future trade agreements don't have to repeat the mistakes of the last 20 years. Rather than a corporate rights model, new models can be used that drive shared prosperity and inclusive growth. New York's fast food workers have won another round in their battle against wage theft. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman reached a deal with 23 Domino's restaurants to settle a wage theft case for $450,000. That's nearly $1 million in lost wages recovered by New York fast food workers in just 2 weeks, as their movement to stamp out wage theft continues. If the minimum wage went to $10.10 an hour, 4 million African-American workers would benefit. A new study called Closing the Gap to the American Dream, based on information from the Economic Policy Institute, found that while African-Americans make up 14% of the workforce, up to 24% of those workers would benefit from a raise in the minimum wage.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Apparently, it's easier to get accepted into an Ivy League school than it is to get a job at Walmart. The Ivy League acceptance rate of 9% makes it among the most selective in the country, but that's a cakewalk compared to landing a job at Walmart. Last year, when Walmart came to Washington, D.C., there were over 20,000 applications for 600 jobs. That's an acceptance rate of 2.6%. That's twice as selective as Harvard's and over five times as choosy as Cornell. But Walmart isn't that unusual. Google accepts only one half of 1% of its job applicants. The U.S. House and Senate have voted overwhelmingly to approve a modest $1 billion aid package for Ukraine, which President Obama said he will sign. The U.S. aid to Ukraine is dwarfed by the $18 billion in loans that the International Monetary Fund has agreed to provide and the $15 billion promised by the European Union. The loans are meant to help Ukraine avoid default to Western banks and to carry it through emergency presidential elections in May. With Russian troops massed on the border with Ukraine, few lawmakers said they were eager for a military confrontation. President Obama and President Putin of Russia have been locked in a tense standoff since Russian forces entered Crimea earlier this month and Russia annexed the region, a move that the United States and its allies refuse to recognize. Today, President Putin called President Obama to discuss a U.S. proposal for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis. According to White House officials, Obama told Putin during the call that the United States would like to see a diplomatic solution that involves Russia pulling back its troops from the Ukrainian border and not making any further steps to invade other parts of Ukraine. The two leaders agreed that their chief diplomats would meet soon to explore the option, the White House said. Putin's telephone call in itself appeared to represent a shift in tone aimed at defusing the conflict. President Obama received the call in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where he has been meeting with King Abdullah to discuss Iran, Syria, and other security issues, but did not discuss Saudi Arabia's numerous human rights abuses.
Same-sex couples will be able to wed from the stroke of midnight tomorrow as the new law permitting same-sex marriage comes into force. As the clock strikes midnight, gay and lesbian couples will be able to wed in the first ever ceremonies in England and Wales. A number are vying to claim the title of being the first ever to be married in Britain by trying to time it perfectly so their vows are said in just seconds after midnight. The Marriage Act came into force in July last year, but it was not until March 13th of this year when couples were able to register their intention to marry under the Act, which states that they then had to wait another 16 days. Other couples who previously married abroad have already had their unions recognized. One man who will wed his partner on Saturday said he could only dream that same-sex marriages would happen during his lifetime.
In Washington, D.C. today, several leading think tanks held a forum on the issue of marijuana legalization. The discussion focused on the impacts of legalization and how strong federal actions could allow states to legalize marijuana while cutting large corporations out of the picture. Mark Kleiman is a marijuana policy expert and contributing editor to The Atlantic, who is one of the speakers on today's panel.
When we talk about drug policy in general, but cannabis policy in particular, both sides of the debate tend to cast their positions in moralistic terms, leading to a very high ratio of heat to light in the debate. So I want to suggest that when we think about cannabis legalization, we think in terms of advantages and disadvantages, good and bad things that will concretely happen in the world as a result. And it seems to me the beginning of wisdom in this business is to acknowledge that both good and bad things will happen as a result of cannabis legalization. 650,000 people a year will not be arrested. 40,000 people will not be behind bars at any one time. Lawbreakers will not earn $40 billion a year for illegal activity. State and local governments and the federal government will not spend a couple of billion dollars a year on enforcement. There's a potential of substantial revenue to the states on the order of maybe $20 billion a year. And 33 million people who smoke marijuana but don't break any other law will suddenly be on the right side of the law rather than on the wrong side of the law. So there's a gain in personal liberty, there's a gain in welfare, consumer welfare, for those cannabis users who do not have a drug problem. The disadvantage of cannabis legalization comes in the increase in the number of people who do have a drug problem. And that's not a tiny number. 2 to 4 million would be a reasonable guess at the number of Americans currently in the grip of substance use disorder where the primary drug involved is cannabis. And those people account for a small fraction of cannabis users. There are about 33 million people who will say in a survey that they've used cannabis in the last year. But they account for more than 90% of the cannabis sold. So they are they're central to the market, and they will be central to the legal market as well. One question that hasn't really come up is, how much training should somebody have to be a cannabis seller? Should that person look more like a bartender or more like a pharmacist? I think Uruguay got that one right. So there's a whole set of questions about how we get information to consumers and what information we get to them. And the Supreme Court's commercial free speech jurisprudence is really in the way of doing that right. One way to get out of that and other problems is not to have commercial retailing. Have retailing be on a not-for-profit basis or on a government monopoly basis. And then the condition of sale from the wholesalers to the retailers could be no marketing. And I think that gets around the First Amendment issue. But something has to be done if we don't want to have a new version of Bud versus Bud Light on next year's Super Bowl. The other crucial factor here, it seems to me, is whether we give the consumers any tools to protect themselves against their own potential bad habits. And it seems to me the obvious thing to do here, though not something we've actually done on any other bad habit-forming activity, is to require everybody who wants to be a cannabis user to sign up and to set a personal quota. How much do you want to be allowed to buy every month? No upper limit on that. You can set any limit you want. And you can reset your limit at any time you want, but only on 2 weeks' notice. But if you get to the store and you've already bought your monthly quota, the clerk will say to you, I'm sorry, I can't serve you till the 12th of next month. I don't know how many people that will save from walking down the sad path to substance use disorder. I can't believe it won't save anybody, and it's hard for me to see any harm it does. So that's the one thing I would want to put on the table as potentially a new idea. And yes, just to anticipate questions, I'd want to apply that to alcohol and to gaming as well.
That was drug policy expert Mark Kleiman speaking at a panel today in Washington, D.C. on the issue of marijuana legalization. In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, earlier today, Taliban fighters stormed a guest house in Kabul, trapping foreigners and aid workers. A bomber rammed the gate to the compound, setting off a bomb that allowed other Taliban fighters to breach the heavily secured gates. At least one Afghan child was killed. The group then took four foreigners hostage before Afghan security forces moved in and killed the attackers. The assault was one of many by the Taliban in recent weeks, leading up to the vote for a new Afghan president on April 5th. The Taliban have condemned the election as sponsored by the West and have vowed to fight the results. The Afghan intelligence agency, called the National Directorate of Security, also announced that it thwarted a bombing attempt in the northern province of Jawzjan. It's not yet confirmed who orchestrated the failed plot. While Jawzjan has remained one of the more peaceful areas of Afghanistan, it has seen more violence recently in the lead-up to the April election.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Carl Vischer, Don Zur, David Lang, Robin Ryan, and Andrew Geller. Our engineer is Ryan Katz. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Special thanks to Ian Gadbury running the board here. Coming up tomorrow morning, or rather Monday morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott welcome Justin Burry of the Community Alliance of Tenants to talk about renters' rights and housing justice in a time of gentrification and urban renewal in Portland. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist, feminist point of view. And at 10, on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein speaks with Elise Higley, campaign director for the Family Farms Measure, about the growing community of organic farmers in Southern Oregon who are banding together to stop the proliferation of genetically modified crops. At 11, we honor the birthday of farm worker and labor leader Cesar Chavez by broadcasting Flight of the Eagle, a documentary on the United Farm Workers Union. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Be sure to stay tuned now for the top headlines of the week and media analysis from Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses. Good night, Diane.
Good night, Jenka.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court hears the Hobby Lobby case, which is about women's health, reproductive rights, and claims of religious freedom. Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check says it's all that and more. One more front in the rights battle against the Affordable Care Act. She'll join us to explain. Also on the show, 25 years after the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound, and the sound is still not fully recovered. And spills are still in the news. The latest are in Galveston Bay and Lake Michigan. What does this say about the state of regulation? We'll talk to Huffington Post environmental reporter Kate Shepard. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
If you repeat something often enough, some people can start to believe it's true. Social Security is going bankrupt, for instance. Something like that seems to be happening with reporting on public workers' pensions. We're told over and over again that the retirement benefits promised to teachers, cops, and firefighters simply cannot be paid in full. A March 22nd piece in USA Today was typical. It leaned on politicians to make this case. Republican New Jersey Governor Chris Christie warned that his state could go the way of Detroit. New Jersey, readers learn, is $52 billion short. And it's hardly alone. Illinois is $187 billion in the hole. Since there's no one in the piece to question this narrative of crisis, it'd be hard to imagine any readers would draw any other conclusion. As the article puts it, states are facing ballooning retiree costs and budget-sucking liabilities. But there are plenty of people who say, hold on a minute. The article never puts those gargantuan numbers in any kind of context. $52 billion owed over how many years? As economist Dean Baker pointed out in a recent column, those amounts represent what is owed over 30 years. In the case of Illinois, that'd be $100 billion in an $18 trillion state economy. It's not nothing, but it helps put things in perspective. He and other analysts point out that pension fund projections made during the economic collapse look bad, but that the recovering stock market will improve the forecast in many states. Who knows whether that will do much to stem the flow of pension panic news reporting?
Venezuelan opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez's op-ed in the New York Times on March 26th was notable because he is currently in military prison there, but also for the correction that was quickly attached to it. Quote, an earlier version of this article incorrectly stated that the more than 30 killed in the political demonstrations in Venezuela since February 4th were protesters. That number includes security forces and civilians, not only protesters, close quote. So the column now says that people on both sides have died. The original claimed all the dead were protesters. The impression that the violence comes from the government is a common one in U.S. and Venezuelan opposition media, which helps to explain why the Times initially printed the error. Much more reliable information can be found at the Center for Economic and Policy Research and Venezuela Analysis, where the deaths for at least the first month of the demonstrations have been carefully detailed. The group's findings largely agree, and as Venezuela Analysis concludes, each side has been directly responsible for about 9 deaths. Opposition barricades have also caused many of the deaths through accidents, delayed ambulances, and fights over their removal. There is a schism in the Venezuelan opposition between those who believe in defeating the Maduro government through democratic means and those, like op-ed writer Lopez, who favor force and street confrontations to remove the government. So it's not surprising that Lopez would conceal the fact that his side has been responsible for many of the deaths. The Times should have been on alert and caught the falsehood before publishing it.
Sometimes corporate media just come out and tell you what their priorities are. Take a March 26th Washington Post story. States use farm bill loophole to stem food stamp cuts. The Post makes clear what it sees as the important point here. The story's lead speaks of the loophole, quote, potentially wiping out billions of dollars in savings Congress agreed to last month, close quote. The last sentence of the piece notes that if states use this loophole, all $8.5 billion in cuts would disappear. Now, to the paper, this is bad news. Cutting food stamps was an important savings, and that is now in doubt. The loophole is a provision in food stamp law that gives slightly higher benefits to people who receive state subsidies for their heating bills. The law was formally written so that people who received as little as $1 in heating aid were eligible for what is known as heat and eat aid. And some states were giving just that much to some of their needy citizens to qualify them. The Republican-led House made it harder to get these supplementary food stamps, so the law was changed so that recipients had to receive at least $20 a year in heating aid to qualify. So governors in 8 states said they would comply with the law by raising their heating subsidies to that amount. This completely predictable response to a legislative change is what the Washington Post is describing as a loophole. It's a little like describing Oliver Twist as the story of a conniving orphan scheming to bust the poorhouse budget by demanding seconds of gruel.
National Review editor Rich Lowry hates military actions based on lies and